Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, I guess any of us over 40, and certainly all of us over 50, have had the experience of getting up to go in the next room to do something and arriving in the next room and not having the slightest idea why you what you went in that room to do. And in my case, it works to go back to where I was and sit down at my desk or wherever it was that I started from, and then I immediately remember again what it was that I wanted to do, and it usually works. But my guest today is an internationally recognized neurobiologist who is a researcher working in the field of learning and memory. His name is Dr. James McGaw. He's a distinguished professor at UC Irvine, University of California, Irvine, the founding director of the Center for the Neurobiology of Learning and Memory out there. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences. So for those of you in my audience who know, that puts him in the top echelon of scientists, and he's been doing this quite a while. Welcome, Dr. McGaw.
Well, thank you very much. It's very nice to be here with you.
If you don't mind, we'll call you Jim. It's just easier.
That's perfectly all right.
Great. Why don't we start off, Jim, by asking you to give us a succinct, if there is such a thing, description of what neurobiologists and, I guess, cognitive neuroscientists, which may be a more specialized or overlapping part of that, do.
What we as a group try to do is to figure out what the brain does when it acquires information, holds that information, and then later uses that information. So we try to figure out what the physiological, biochemical, and molecular processes are, essentially, that enable us to learn and to remember. And it requires all kinds of technology to do that. There's no single approach. It's a multidisciplinary attempt.
All right. So to put it in more hardware terms than software terms, you work on the ROM and the RAM and the hard drive storage of the human brain or something like that.
Yes, something like that. We work on the machinery of the brain. That is why it is that you and I can remember what we did yesterday and maybe what we did a number of years ago. What are the processes that enable the information to be acquired in the first place, held over a long period of time, and then retrieved at a later time? A very complicated set of processes. We have to recognize at the outset that the brain is the most complicated known structure in the universe. And of the things that it does, I would hold memory is the most important. That's the most important function of the brain, because if you don't have memory, you don't care if you lack something else.
What was the movie a few years ago? I think it was Adaptation. I'm not sure. There was somebody who couldn't remember anything beyond a few seconds. I didn't see the movie, but it sounded like an interesting concept, and he was trying to solve a problem while dealing with this great disability. Are you familiar with what I'm talking
about?
Yes,
and there are humans like that. That movie was based on knowledge that there are humans who have suffered surgery and damage to the brain that enables them to remember for a very brief period of time, but not to store new information on a permanent basis. And those kinds of patients actually have provided important clues that have guided research.
Wow. So you described what cognitive neuroscientists, I guess, do. And what have you specifically focused on during your career? Is it a subset of that or broadly that?
Well, it's a subset of that. I've worked primarily, if not exclusively, on the question of how we form memories. I've been less focused on how we retrieve information at a later time, but rather how we make memories in the first place. Now, the fundamental research that I and others like me do is based on early findings that when we learn something, it takes a while for the brain to make a permanent record of that. And the process, the word that's used to describe this process is consolidation. That is, we acquire some information, and that information has to be fixed slowly over a period of time in order for it to become permanent. And in the meantime, we use other memory processes that differ from that. So to put it clearly, our ability to carry on a conversation of the present time and remember what you just said and you remember what I just said is not based on the same mechanisms that allow us to remember this tomorrow and the week afterwards, because those processes occur slowly. So that's what I've been interested in, is a question of how permanent memories are made slowly over a period of time. And I've done that primarily with the use of pharmacological agents, that is, drugs. I discovered many years ago that it is possible to enhance the formation of memories by injecting laboratory animals with stimulant drugs shortly after they are trained. that is to enhance these consolidation processes. Then I investigated the processes that go on in the brain that enable that to happen and what kind of brain systems are involved that have to be engaged in order to make that work. Now, a key change in my thinking came a number of years after I did my first experiments, because I asked the question, why is it that we have brains that consolidate information slowly anyway? Why don't we just consolidate information, bang, like
instantly.
That?
Yeah.
And so what came to me and my coworkers was the idea that the reason we consolidate things slowly is because that allows endogenous processes, that's things that are going on in the body and the brain, to regulate the strength of the storage of that information. So we have an experience, and now there's a period of time in which things that are going on in the body and in the brain can regulate how strongly that memory will be stored. And we made a guess as to what those processes might be, and our guess was stress hormones.
Hmm.
That was our initial guess, and it turned out that that was an excellent guess, because when we have any kind of an experience, we release stress hormones. We release adrenaline, epinephrine, the scientific word for adrenaline, from the adrenal medulla located near the back, and we also release cortisol. These are two stress hormones that are released, and to make a very long story short, what we found was that when we train animals or humans on some task and then administer to them cortisol or adrenaline shortly afterwards, that enhances the memory. So that these are hormones that we release ourselves when we get excited about something, and they play a role in strengthening the memory of experience that occurred shortly before the release of the hormones.
Okay, so if I can summarize that briefly in somewhat more 30,000-foot level terms, the intensity of the experience controls or dictates the intensity of the consolidation of the memory, or how deeply the memory is laid down, or how vividly it's laid down. In other words,
yes,
emotion influences memory. And so the more emotional you are,
right,
about the experience, the deeper the memory is, the maybe the more vivid, the longer lasting the memory is. Is that more
exactly,
or less?
Exactly. The stronger the memory will be, the more long lasting the memory will be. And the key ingredient that emotion uses is the release of stress hormones that then act on the brain. And the second stage then of the research that I and others have been doing is to figure out how these hormones act in the brain to produce that effect.
Hmm.
So that's the second stage, and involves a lot of experiments with both animals and humans. With animals, it involves administering drugs directly into specific brain regions to block the action of hormones or to promote the action of hormones within the brain. And we've identified some structures in the brain that are critical for that. And in humans, it is involved doing imaging of the brain to see what brain regions are activated by stress hormones or by emotional experiences, and which of the activated brain regions predict then lasting memory. So that's the kind of experiments that we've done with humans.
Okay, well, it definitely sounds like laboratory science. So you talked about stress hormones and adrenaline and things that I associate more with fight or flight, more with stressful situations. How about positive emotions? I mean, how about love, or, you know, and so on? Aren't those emotions laid down just as strongly? And if so, aren't they different chemical precursors that cause them to be enacted that way, right?
It works the same way.
Okay.
It works the same way. Now, in the case of laboratory animals, we've done some experiments showing that positive emotional experiences will also make lasting memories using the same mechanisms. In humans, the experiments have been done showing subjects either very pleasant material to look at or very unpleasant material to look at while their brains are being scanned, and then testing for memory of that material at a later time. And it turns out that it doesn't make any difference whether the material is very pleasant or whether it is very unpleasant. As long as it's emotionally exciting, it will activate a very specific region of the brain called the amygdala, which is Greek for almond. It's an almond-shaped structure that we have on two sides of our brain.
Mm.
When that gets activated, the degree of activation of that, as measured by functional imaging, predicts how well that information is remembered weeks later, whether it is good or bad. It's not a question of it being unpleasant. It can be very pleasant, and it'll be well remembered. and it's well remembered because it activates this very specific region of the brain.
My guess is that it also focuses your memory. I remember when I was 21, I guess, and was in a summer job, I was held up at gunpoint, and I don't think I remember the face of the man behind the gun, but I have an extremely vivid memory of that large round hole looking at my face, the end of the gun. So, well, what?
Yeah, that actually has been studied. That is, there have actually been studies of memories of people who have been robbed, and they don't always remember all of the details of the robbery, but some of them they remember very, very well for a very long period of time.
That's right. Yeah, that's the business end. So, what do they think lays down, if I can call it that, lays down memories? Is it molecular? Are these molecules that are marshaled to arrive at the amygdala and occupy a little space there, and they become a code for a memory?
Well, my own research suggests that the amygdala is not the locus of the memory, but rather the amygdala is richly interconnected with lots of other brain regions. And what it does, in effect, is to say to the other brain regions, you've got information that's just arrived there, make a stronger memory. That is, it's a modulator, it's an instructor.
Okay. All right.
But changes do have to take place. Ultimately, memories are going to turn out to have a molecular basis. There have to be changes that take place in the connections among the nerve cells of the brain in order to hold that information. And the best evidence that we have says that different kinds of information are held in different parts of the brain, depending upon where the information was first activated. So if it's visual information, it's going to be in the visual cortex. If it was auditory information, sounds, it's going to be in the auditory cortex. And what the memory consists of is a widespread connection of the cells across the brain that will integrate this into a memory. So a memory is not located some place in the brain, but a memory consists of an orchestration of these connections that have been made throughout the brain as a consequence of the learning experience.
Well, briefly, is it molecular or cellular?
At what level? Both.
Okay. Well, I mean, yeah, but I mean, are memories retained as a molecular cluster? Is it that tiny?
No. Memories are retained as a function of the connection of cells.
Okay.
Now, the making of the connection is going to be a molecular process. That is, the connection between two cells, or in this case, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of cells, those connections are going to be based on molecular changes that occur. But the memory is going to be held in the interaction of these cells that are widely distributed throughout the brain.
Okay.
So that it is both a molecular process in terms of making the connections, let's say soldering the cells together, and it's going to be a cellular process in terms of the activation of nerve cells that are widely distributed.
All right, well, here's one reason I wanted to ask you that question. Starting, I don't know, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, I started noticing that I would have just spontaneous memories would pop into my mind of things that I had no idea that I remembered, and they were trivial. They weren't emotional, intensely remembered experiences or events. You know, it'd be a mental image of my pulling up to a stop sign in Arlington, Virginia, and making a right-hand turn in 1978 or thereabouts. I couldn't remember the date, you know, but sometime, you know, quite a while back in my personal history. And these things would occur fairly often. I don't mean that this is a problem, but it would be every 2 or 3 days, and I would be working or talking on the phone or something. It wasn't connected to any kind of trigger, you know, nothing reminded me of it. There was no smell, no sound, no sensory input that brought that memory up. It just seemed like it popped spontaneously. And this would happen. I did notice that there was a pattern to it, and I still do. This still happens, you know, occasionally. And I noticed that there's a pattern to it that over a period of time, I'll have a series of these little spontaneous pops that are clustered in time. I mean, it might be all 1978 or 79, and then it will shift to 1985 or 6 or something like that. And I just wonder what causes that. And I think that what happens then, this is something I would not have remembered, but it makes me think that everything you ever experienced, no matter how trivial, you remember. And sometimes these spontaneous memories are of dreams that I had many years ago. And it's little fragments. It's not like a long story. It's a little spontaneous snapshot, you know. And so then once that occurs, I remember that memory because I think that remembering the memory must create a new memory, or at least it refreshes the old memory, however that mechanism would work. But what do you think about that?
Well, there are several questions there. First of all, I would like to know that you are, in fact, remembering something that really happened the way that you were remembering it.
I'm pretty sure I do. I mean, I remember it, I actually do remember it, and it's connected to something else, and I'll be driving a car I owned at that time, and I'll be seeing someone sitting in the right side of the seat who was somebody I knew at that moment, and it's not a dream or a fantasy. I'm pretty sure it's real memories. But
well,
anyway,
you're pretty sure. But see, my job as a scientist is to be a skeptic.
Yeah, I know. Well, okay, go ahead.
Our job as scientists is to kill bad ideas. That's what science is about. Everybody has ideas. So I would first want to know, did in fact what you were thinking about happen in exactly that way? And if you kept a diary, or if there were a film of that, then I could use that to validate it. So that's the first question I have. Now let's suppose you pass that test.
Yeah, right.
Then the question would be, how strong and accurate is that memory? And if that memory is strong and accurate, then I would ask, what were the cues that actually elicited it? Because I don't think that it's just going to happen randomly pop into your head. And then we could explore that and see what kind of associations led you to thinking about that. That would be a way of discovering what the retrieval mechanisms are that cue these memories and cause them to come out again. So there'd be you raise a lot of questions there in reporting your experiences about these memories.
Yeah, and I realize that what I just described, I'm confident in myself because I'm pretty self-aware and I can distinguish reality from fantasy pretty well. I'm confident in myself that these are actual memories of things that did occur, and I'm astonished at how trivial they are, and it's not something I would have remembered beyond the next day, let's say. But I'm confident that they're there, and they pop up spontaneously with no... I have to ask you to ignore me, basically, because what I'm saying is not provable in any way, but I'm pretty confident of it. So if you posit that it were true and I kept a diary day by day of turning right at this stoplight, which no one would ever do, but if you posit it that were true, what might be, hypothetically, if I can ask an eminent scientist to speculate, hypothetically, what could cause a spontaneous emission, if you want to call it that, of long forgotten trivial memory?
Well, I can't provide an account of why something would occur spontaneously. I would be more likely to say that there was some cue that was associated with that that elicited it, and that you were unaware of the connection between the cue and that memory. It might have been a smell. It might have been a contour. It might have been something that came over the radio. I wouldn't know, but I would say that there's always some kind of an eliciting cue that's going to trigger that memory. It's not going to occur spontaneously. But, these are the kinds of things that are very hard to study.
And possibly this is as yet to be explained, because I think I would point to the time clustering of them over a period of time, where over a period of a month I might spontaneously, as I call it, remember things from 21 years ago, and then it shifts later. But anyway, let's move on from that. We are talking with Dr. James McGaugh, who's an eminent neurobiologist at the University of California at Irvine, about learning and memory and the connections between them. Why don't we turn to age-related memory changes, which our baby boom generation is becoming more and more aware of. For example, as I said at the outset, the thing that's very common that everybody begins to laugh about uncomfortably, that you forget. Short-term memory gets more and more problematic. You remember long-term just fine, but the whatever happened 10 minutes ago or that you thought 10 minutes ago can elude you. What is that, the loss of short-term memory?
There's bad news and good news.
All right.
The bad news is that with regard to the ability of making and retaining new memories, that ability begins to decline at the age of 26 and declines linearly throughout life, almost until and unless some disease hits, such as Alzheimer's or something like that later on in life. It's just a gradual decline in the ability to acquire and retrieve information over the lifespan. So that at the age of 80, someone is significantly less able to acquire and retrieve memories than they were at the age of 25. There's just no doubt about it. And then after the age of 80, there's an increase, a great increase in the onset of diseases of memory, such as Alzheimer's disease. So that's the bad news. Now, the good news is that counteracting that over the course of a lifetime is the acquisition of knowledge, and so wisdom increases, and that to a very large extent overbalances. So we have much more information to call on, even though we may have increasing difficulty in calling on it. So wisdom balances against the loss of the ability to acquire information that occurs gradually but inexorably over the lifespan. Good news and bad news.
Well, there are times when that trade-off doesn't seem so positive, but I think on a common sense basis, most people explain that to themselves and each other, at least possibly or potentially, as being something like, again, the analogy with a computer, that your memory banks are full, and so you can't you can't retain trivia that well anymore as you did when you were 25. Because
it's not that they're full. It's okay. Just that the ability to acquire that information is not as strong.
Okay.
To acquire it and to hold on to it. On the other hand, for the well-formed memories that are strong, those are still available, and the more we learn about the world, the richer the interconnections we have, and the more intelligent we are in some broad social sense of intelligence. That goes up with age, whereas the ability to acquire this new information goes down. That's solid information.
I understand what you're saying. I think, too, there must be a factor of, as we settle into our routine and our rut in life, as long as things aren't too stressful, you're doing the same thing day in and day out, and sometimes it gets hard to remember whether this is Monday or Thursday and whether this thing we're talking about happened last Christmas or the Christmas before, because they all kind of run together. And so I think that you tend to remember, at least I recognize that I tend to remember long ago events more vividly than recent ones, because there's sort of, I guess you could call it, a boredom factor sets in or too much routine. And so you don't lay down or consolidate those memories as intensely as you did when they were new.
Well, they're also confused because, as you put it, there's so much repetition. But on the other hand, if you stop and think about it, I could ask you about yesterday, your yesterday, and you can give me a pretty good rundown on what you did yesterday.
I hope so.
So that you have I think you probably have a very strong memory of what you did yesterday. Not so strong ability to recall what you did 2 days ago, unless it was an important day, and so on. So we do have pretty good memories of fairly recent events, even though they're a routine, even though they may be much like the previous days, they will still stand out.
How much of memory is photographic? I mean, we're familiar with the term photographic memory, but my memory is partly photographic in that, like, for example, I've always noticed that if I read a book, and then I want to find a certain passage, I can very easily remember where on the page, whether it's a right page or left page, and how far down the page that passage was. And I can kind of visually see that in my mind's eye. And so I flip quickly through looking at that spot on the right-hand page, and then it's easy to find. I don't know how common that is, but maybe it's very common. But how photographic is memory, do you think?
In my view, not at all.
Oh.
I don't know of any strong evidence of what would be photographic memory in the camera-like sense. There are certainly highly accurate and highly inaccurate memories, but what you just described is a very common thing where we recall the localization of things. Yes, it was about two-thirds of the way through the book and halfway down the page and so on.
Yeah.
But it's not as though you could call up an image of that page and read it off.
Oh, right.
As though you were reading the book for the first time.
That's
so
right.
So that the likelihood of there being that kind of memory, I put it at a very small likelihood, even though there are individual differences in the ability of people to recall information.
Yeah, I would not claim to have a photographic memory at all, but still my sense of that is visual, like I guess I would call it. And by the same token, I can recall a conversation with somebody, and I will visually have an image of them standing there in a certain position and the configuration, you know, their relative position relative to me, and I can recall the conversation with that visual component to it. Is that pretty common?
Yes, yeah, that's common, but it's not photographic in the sense that I couldn't say if you go down 3 inches, what was the color of the flower in the lapel?
Yeah, right.
And you know, how many rings on the finger?
Yeah, okay.
And so on. No, it's not that kind of detail where you could read it off the way you can if you look at a picture. It's not like that at all.
Sure.
You grasp some of the elements, and then you reconstruct that for your own use.
Yeah, so there's a visual component to memory is all that is then.
Of course, yes.
Well, let's talk about something else, and we just have a couple minutes left, and I don't know if we can do this justice in 2 or 3 minutes, but there is something that you've become well-known in lately in the last few years that's actually just, I think, kind of an adjunct to what you really do your research in, but it's called, in general, as I understand it, superior autobiographical memory. And if I can explain it in 25 words or less, it's there are a few people who have a compendious memory of everything that's occurred in most of their lives, in some cases back to early childhood, in some cases to early teenage or whatever, but it's a calendar-based type of memory. And you can say, what happened on, you know, August 8th, 1965, and they'll immediately tell you, and then you have ways to check that. Or, and in their case of their own personal experience, they sometimes have a diary. There was one woman named AJ, who was kind of a mysterious personage for a while, who I think that's the first time I ran across your research a few years back. You published the story of this woman whose pseudonym was AJ, who is one of these people, and I think she's recently come out with a book called The Woman Who Can't Forget, and her name is Jill Price, and she lives in the L.A. area. But that's a very interesting phenomenon that I had not heard of before. And have you found a few other people who evidently have that capacity? Why don't you tell us just briefly about a couple
of
them?
Yeah, we now have identified 7 people who have this ability. And by this ability, I mean the ability to recall day by day what happened in their lives, both personally and for public events. And we have checked this both with the public events, because that information is available, highly accurate, with respect to what happened on a particular day. And also for their personal lives, because either they kept diaries or they had date books or they had memorabilia that we could use to test them. And they are really very highly accurate, starting at about the age of 13, let's say, 11 to 13. And so we have been interested in why it is they have this remarkably strong event memory. It's not photographic, it's event. They describe the day the way that you and I would describe our yesterdays.
Yeah.
That it's that degree of accuracy, no more or no less than that.
That's astounding.
So we have been working to authenticate it, to make sure that these individuals actually can do it, and then we have been attempting to find out what it is about them, about their brains in particular, that enables them to do that. So it's an ongoing, very complicated research project that we're working intensely on now.
That's an amazing capability, probably new to most of our listeners. Well, we are out of time. I always wish we had another 15 minutes to half an hour more to talk with my guest. This is another case of that. But Dr. James McGaugh, Jim, I'd like to thank you for being on with us here on American Variety.
Well, Cord, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
It's been very interesting. Thanks to you all for listening, and I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.